Support for the National Writers Series is brought to you by the Wege Foundation, dedicated to developing leaders in economicology, health, education, and arts, and enhancing the lives of people in West Michigan and around the world.
Welcome to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Nelson DeMille has written 21 novels, including Plum Island, The Charm School, and The Cuban Affair. His book, The General's Daughter, was made into a movie starring John Travolta. Nelson's latest book, The Deserter, is a collaboration with his son, Alex, who is a screenwriter and film editor. Nelson and Alex talk this hour with WTCM News Talk 580 radio host, Ron Jolly. Ron asked Nelson to talk about a time in his life before he became a writer, serving in the U.S. Army in Vietnam.
I was 3 years in college, and I had my student deferment, and I got bored one day, and January 66, and I said, I need some adventure, and I left college, and while I was thinking about what adventure I wanted, the draft board, I think within 30 days, had my name and number, and I got my draft notice, but I wasn't going to let them draft me, so I went and I enlisted. And then I served 3 years in the United States Army. Went to Officer Candidate School at Fort Benning, graduated, trained troops for a while, spent a month in Panama in jungle training school, which was kind of a clue of where I was going after Panama. And spent a year in Vietnam with the 1st Cavalry Division. And you might know the 1st Cavalry from the movie Apocalypse Now. That was my unit. And came back, finished my degree, and had my belly full of adventure, but decided I wanted to write about my experience in Vietnam, which got me into the process of writing. I didn't really do that book right away. I didn't do that book until really Word of Honor many years later, and then a book called Upcountry years after that. But it was the Army experience. Thank you. Thank you. So that's, in a nutshell, that was my Vietnam. It seems like, you know, as the years go by, it seems people ask me about Vietnam, I have trouble remembering, which I think is a good thing. But I did go back in 97. I went back with two other guys who had served at the same time I was there. One of them was a childhood friend, one was a recent friend. But coincidentally, we'd all been there at the same time, which was late 67 into 68, and that was during the Tet Offensive, and you know, the probably the worst year of the war, 1968. We went back in 97 to kind of retrace our steps of where we'd been, what we'd done, looking for our old girlfriends who were 30 years older now and hard to find. But it was kind of cathartic, and there was some, you know, kind of emotional, I think, emotional moments. We went there in January because we wanted to be there during the Tet holiday. So we'd been there during the Tet Offensive in 68, and we wanted to go at that specific time. And what came out of that was my book, Upcountry. I went there to write a magazine article, but the article got longer and longer and longer and longer, and I wound up with a book. So, in a nutshell, that's my, and there probably will not be any more Vietnam books unless somebody really insists.
Alex grew up with a writer, novelist, and went into film. So you picked up a little bit of the storytelling gene, but why did you choose that path as opposed to writing books?
I was probably afraid to be compared to him. I mean, honestly, one of the greatest gifts that you gave me growing up with you was kind of the permission to pursue a creative career. So I did grow up, you know, you see your dad writing books, like, oh, I want to do that too, I can do that. So I'd write short stories. I attempted a couple of ridiculously ambitious novels when I was like 22. But I decided that I liked filmmaking. It was kind of a fun hobby. I thought, oh, this is a hobby that maybe I could turn into something more. And I figured it's adjacent to what he's doing. So it's still a way to connect. It's a way to get feedback from him and still be someone, it'd be in the creative world. So I moved to LA and I went to UCLA and got my graduate degree in film directing. And I met my wife there, which was probably the best thing to come out of that, going to that school. But it's hard, you know, if you're from somewhere else and you go to LA or you're somewhere else and you go to New York and you're trying to be there as a creative professional, it's really hard, I think, to build a network. You know, I'm not talking about connections and networking of people above you that can help you. I'm talking about people, your peers, people trying to do the same thing as you, which is so important. So I went to Los Angeles and I immediately had like 20 of my best friends who all wanted to also all be directors and screenwriters. So it was a nice community right off the bat, which made the move a little less intimidating and the idea of pursuing this really, really difficult industry more a little easier. And yeah, so then I made some shorts. I was able to get an agent, a film agent out there, and a manager. And I started writing my own screenplays, and I got into film editing, as was mentioned. And yeah, that's what I was kind of doing until I got a phone call one day.
Yeah. Alex has a website, as does almost everybody these days, I think. What's the 30-minute short, the title?
It's called The Absence.
Yeah, The Absence. If you want to check that out, I saw some of it today, very intense. Great storytelling.
Thank you.
So now father and son team up here for their first of three novels, a contract for three with the same characters. The Deserter, which is fast-paced. I can't wait to get home and read it, and it's one of the reasons I was late today. Alex, can you give us a summary of The Deserter?
Sure. So The Deserter, it is a story about two agents in this Army CID, which is the Criminal Investigation Division. It's the branch of the Army which is responsible for prosecuting crimes or investigating crimes committed within the Army by Army personnel, you know, or to Army personnel. And Scott Brody, Maggie Taylor, male-female CID team, are tasked with finding Kyle Mercer, Captain Kyle Mercer, and he's an infamous Army deserter, loosely based on Bo Bergdahl, though we changed him into a captain in Delta Force. And he, like Bo Bergdahl, had walked off of his base, been captured by the Taliban, held by the Taliban for 2 years. Unlike Bo Bergdahl, he escaped by himself and killed all of his captors, and leaves a very haunting message for his commanding officers in the Army. So Scott Brody and Maggie Taylor, he's spotted in Caracas, Venezuela, and nobody knows why the hell he would go from Afghanistan to Venezuela, but that's the central mystery of the book. So our two CID agents are tasked with going to Caracas, locating him, detaining him, and bringing him back to face court-martial for his desertion. So there's a lot of mysteries up front. Why did he desert? How did he escape capture? And why would he end up in Venezuela? So there's a lot more to the story than bringing a deserter to justice, but that's kind of the entry point to it.
And as I read, and if you are as well, or when you do, you'll continue to ask yourself, why did he desert? Why is he in Venezuela? And so on. I think maybe your second collaboration, Nelson, but the first here. So is it true when you called Alex to see if he wanted to work on this project, you asked him if he wanted to make some easy money?
He didn't say easy, right?
Something like that. For some reason, my publisher wanted me to commit to a three-book contract with three collaborations with the same collaborator, if possible, but with the same characters, a continuing series of Scott Brody and Maggie Taylor. And I had a collaborator up front. I didn't want to pick one because then, you know, if it went wrong, then it was my fault. Yeah, I'd like to blame authors for everything, but that's another story. We had a little contest, and we picked somebody who's a fairly, you know, accomplished writer, but I couldn't get along with him for a variety of reasons. You know, it's called clashing egos. So I put the project aside, but the project was a good project. The publisher really was interested in this kind of takeoff on the Bo Bergdahl case, and I left it, you know, while I was working on the Cuban affair. And then when the Cuban affair was done, they came back to me and they said, "Now, what are you doing with The Deserter? We actually had a name for it too." And I said, I'm looking for somebody to, you know, wants to make easy money. And I, for some reason, I don't even know why, I was sitting in a chair one night, I was reading something, and it just struck me that I needed the collaborator. I said, "I know somebody who writes, my son." And I just called him out of the clear blue sky without much thought. And, he didn't exactly jump on it, even when I said, "You want to make some money? Usually your children will respond immediately."
But I asked you, "What do I have to do for it?" And then you told me.
And yet, instinctively, I knew it was going to work. I really knew it was going to work. I knew that Alex's strengths were, you know, as a screenwriter, were bringing in this idea of, you know, the arc of the story, as they say in screenwriting. Every story is supposed to be three acts, act one, act two, act three. So he knew all the structures. He knew the how to pace a story. And he knew how to, you know, he was a good storyteller. And I'd actually read some of the novels that he'd begun back when he was in college and post-college. So I knew he knew how to write. He knew how to write prose, you know, beyond writing, you know, dialogue for a screenplay. And I instinctively knew it was going to work. We had to just figure out the logistics. We don't live that far apart, about 20 miles apart. He lives in Brooklyn, I live in Long Island. It's not that far geographically, but it's worlds apart between Brooklyn and suburban Long Island. But, you know, with the internet and emails and all that, you might want to talk about that process for a minute, the actual collaboration later, you know.
I say, so people know, Nelson has written 21 novels now with a number one pencil and a legal pad. Now, how many legal pads do you go through on an average novel?
Gosh, I probably leveled the forest by now. I don't type. And, you know, we all learned how to write in first grade with a pencil and a paper. And I haven't really progressed beyond that much. And but it works. It works for me. I mean, and all novelists, you know, I'm going to defend my writing by hand. Novelists right up until the turn of the last century were writing, you know, with a pen or a pencil. And Mark Twain was one of the first ones to use a typewriter. And there are people who swear that his writing got worse when he went to the typewriter, because there's this machine in between you and your thoughts. And I actually spoke to a neurologist once who had done some work on this and said the same thing that I believed, which is the writing process with the hand and the brain directly without anything in between makes it go faster. This is what I tell everybody, because I don't know how to type, so it sounds good. But Alex is a quick typer, and he's got a computer, and he was emailing me manuscripts. And
I think I broke my brain pretty early, because I got like a computer in like early 90s, and it was a new thing, a personal computer in your house, and I was excited by it. So I think I just started typing, and that's, you know, that's also when I was like 11 or 12 years old, I started doing short stories on that. So that I was kind of immediately, I was associating typing with creative writing almost off the bat.
So question is, can you read your dad's handwriting?
Most of it. Mostly. I'd say it's hard to, I'd say about 95% of it. And then the other 5%, I just was taking screenshots of the you know, scribbles and emailing them to his assistants and saying, what is this? And then half the time they would tell me, and half the time they would say, we don't know either. We're going to go upstairs and ask him. So.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, Nelson and Alex DeMille talk more about how the Bo Bergdahl case inspired their new novel, The Deserter.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to Ron Jolly's conversation with Nelson and Alex DeMille.
I'm fascinated by writers, and I ask every writer I interview, and I get almost the same answer. They say, I don't know how it works. But if you think as a reader, in this book, you're getting to know Maggie and Scott, the CID investigating team, and Kyle Mercer is the guy they're after, and the bit players, and they become people to you. You might have an image of what they look like. There are locations. You can imagine the roads, the hotels, and it becomes a world which we inhabit as readers, but doesn't exist, except in their heads, which is really fascinating to me. So I guess I would start on this book, The Deserter.
What was the seed there? What was the first idea, and who did it come from? What was the seed that got this going, that before you could collaborate together?
Well, it was the idea, I mean, that I had brought to the publisher years before of the Bergdahl desertion fascinated me. And I think because, you know, I was in the Army, I was in a combat zone the way Bergdahl was in Afghanistan, and I couldn't imagine myself walking off my post into enemy territory. It just made no sense to me. And I said, this is a fascinating, you know, news story. But then when he was released and he was exchanged for some Taliban prisoners, and it turned out that he wasn't, after all, that interesting. In fact, he was kind of a loser. But that would not make a good novel. But it was a jump-off point. It was a starting point. I mean, I'm still not quite sure why Bergdahl deserted, but we had to come up with something interesting of why our guy, Captain, and he's a captain, Captain Kyle Mercer, Delta Force, would have deserted his post, left his men, gone off into Taliban territory, and what was that all about? That's one of the mysteries of it. So, you know, like a lot of novels, you take something that you've heard or seen, something that interests you, and you have to dramatize it. You take a little literary license, and your jump off point has to be reality, unless you're writing fantasy novels. And I gave the project to Alex, you know, kind of already half baked. We already knew we were going to do that, but then Alex had to go with it. And you know, where is Bergdahl spotted? Alex picked like one of the worst places in the universe right now, Caracas, Venezuela, the murder capital of the world. That was his idea. And then he's spotted by an army buddy, our guy, Kyle Mercer, who happens to be in Caracas on business. And the guy does the right thing and he calls an army friend who eventually goes up the chain of command. And when the book opens, we've already got Bergdahl spotted in Caracas, Venezuela, and our two heroes, our protagonists, are being briefed about going to Caracas, finding the Bergdahl character, Kyle Mercer, and bringing him back to justice.
Alex, I saw on your website you chose Venezuela. Where did he escape to? Where did he go? Venezuela, Caracas. You wrote, I also picked Venezuela because it's dangerous and therefore it's interesting. Part of a storyteller's job is to build a dynamic world and to put dynamic people in it and to throw everything you can at those people and hope they rise to the challenge or fail in an interesting way. Sending our heroes to Caracas seemed like a perfect way to screw up their day and see how and if they made it out alive. So when you began the collaboration together, that means you didn't know the ending? You don't have an outline that tells you, we're at point A, we have to get to point Z, and here's how we'll go? Was it just open?
We kind of had an ending, but you know, I in my mind, no, we thought the book was going to end, you know, in Caracas. It was supposed to be, you know, an urban thriller, but then Alex had the idea of, and sometimes it's the research leads you to places. Really looking at a map of Venezuela, I realized that the south part of Venezuela was part of the Amazon rainforest, and we decided that Kyle Mercer needed to get out of Caracas and wind up in the, we were both thinking the same thing, I think, the heart of darkness and Apocalypse Now, that we want this book to end in the jungle, in that dark kind of heart of darkness kind of place. Caracas was bad enough, the jungle turns out to be worse. And we got that far, but we still didn't know actually how it was going to end. And eventually you have to end it because you got to turn it in at some point. And that's where you have the real story conferences of, we had story conferences as we went along, of course. But the big one is always, how is this book going to end? A lot of people, you know, are led down a lot of paths in the book. They like the book. And, you know, when you read the reviews, a lot of readers complain about the ending. The ending was not satisfying. The ending was too quick. The ending wasn't believable. The ending this, and then the editors say the same thing. I'm not sure this is the right ending. And I think you found the same thing in the movie business. It's all about, it seems to be all about the ending. And so, you know, I have so much experience with with arguing with editors about endings, how they should, how things should end. We wanted to make this one the best ending we could, so we couldn't, we didn't have any blowback from the editors. So I said to Alex, you know, make believe it's a movie, end it.
Yeah. I mean, I think the best endings are unpredictable, but then feel inevitable once they've happened. I'm not sure we did that, but that's always the goal, I think, you know, good storytelling. You're like, of course, that's how, it's the only way it could have happened, but it didn't occur to me until I saw it happen. There's central mysteries to the book. So at some point we kind of paused and had a meeting to say, okay, the characters are asking themselves constantly, why did he desert? Why did he desert? Well, why did he desert? You know, we had to kind of figure out the central mystery. And once we had that figured out, that was kind of like the center of the onion. Then it kind of gave us all the different layers of, they're going to find this out, then they're going to find this out. That's not the plot. That's just the pacing of revealing information. And of course you have to figure out how you're doing it. And that's what makes it interesting. And Kyle Mercer he's essentially a kind of Colonel Kurtz, the Apocalypse Now character anyway. So once we decided on the jungle, of course, it made perfect sense. Of course, this is where he's going to go. And I figured you could probably describe the jungle pretty well from your experience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was in the jungle once. Yeah. But yeah, once we got there, we knew it. The other mystery of the book was, you know, not only why did he desert, but why did he go to Venezuela? And we had to come up with that, you know. A lot of what a novelist does, I think, is, you know, some novelists work from a real good outline, like a 30 or 40 page, real outline kind of thing. But I find that if you let it go a little bit and go off the roadmap that you've already plotted out, or if you have plotted it out, that sometimes more interesting things come up. As if, for instance, us thinking that this book was all going to be set, the last three quarters of the book were going to be set in Caracas, until we looked at a map, and that just triggered the whole thing. So, you know, you're living the book as you're writing it. The process takes 12 to 16 months, and during that time, you are living with the characters, you're living with the world of the book that you created, and you have the luxury of being able to go back to chapter one if you have to plan something that needs to happen in chapter 35. In the movie business, I guess, when stage plays, they say, if you show a gun in act one, you better use it in act three. So we needed the gun, we needed the mystery, and, you know, we were really going along fine until we started painting ourselves into a corner. Like, why did he go to Caracas? And why did he desert? I mean,
but we came up with great answers, you should say.
We came up with great answers, though, I think, anyway.
Can't wait to find out. You guys are not going to win any awards from the Caracas Visitors Bureau, that's right, for sure. Now, a lot of the Caracas Venezuelan research, Alex, you did. How realistic do you think you portrayed Caracas to the reader? We're talking about a lawless society, corrupt police, streets that close at dark, at dusk, government-sanctioned gangs, danger, robbery, murder around every corner, especially for Americans who are unwelcome. Is that fairly accurate, do you think?
Because I didn't go, I was a little self-conscious about the accuracy. And when I showed it to, I spoke to a number of Venezuelan expats, and when I showed them certain passages or certain chapters, and one woman said to me, I said up front, because I was like, listen, this is a, you know, this is a thriller, it's a piece of commercial fiction. If it feels a little over the top or a little, you know, sensationalized, you know, that kind of comes with the territory. But, you know, I was just trying, you know. And then she says, no, not at all. This is like I was reading my life. I was like, oh God, that's horrible, you know. And then they have to have a kind of dark sense of humor about it, even though every story you'd hear about every person who left had their own moment. You know, I was riding in a car, and then, you know, in a upscale neighborhood, and somebody shot through the window of my car, and I almost hit me. Or my friend's boyfriend was arrested by the secret police and tortured for a week. Or, you know, and this is the stories of people who have money and means. This is, you know, never mind the people who are just
barely getting by and have to like sift through garbage to find food. So it was a tough place to research because it's just a complex situation and because it's just, it can be really dark. What was the question?
Do you believe that your portrayal is fairly accurate?
I think
of the dangers that exist there?
Yeah, I mean, there was two things. The first was, are we describing the kind of topography and geography and how everything looks accurately? Because that's the first thing you need to make sure you're doing. And then it was okay if we were exaggerating a little bit, but we had to make sure, it felt real. And no, I think it was accurate. I mean, there's different kinds of gangs. There's drug gangs, and then the government themselves, outside of our military, they have their own gangs that they arm. They're basically almost like a lawless militia, but they kind of act on behalf of the president. And then there's all these other warring factions, and it's a complex and dangerous place. So I figured, kind of anything we could come up with as far as a dangerous situation would be pretty believable. But the other thing is, it's still a place where you could go to a street, and it's not. It's not like Somalia. It's not, Baghdad in the middle of the war. It is still a place where there's shops open and people, there's malls, and people are sort of living their lives, but that's kind of what makes it a little eerie, because then suddenly, at any moment, something terrible could happen. And there's an entire cottage industry of people being, you know, kidnapped for money. I think it was pretty accurate.
I think Nelson's website has Strand Magazine did an interview with you guys and asked both of you to pick your favorite thrillers, action adventures, intrigue, whatever you want to call the category of novel. And between the two of you, you came up with a lot of old school Brits, mostly, and Cold War subject matter. You've got John le Carré, Ian Fleming, Graham Greene, Joseph Conrad, James Grady, 3 Days of the Condor, or Len Deighton, and others. Are there any current writers that you would say you follow or admire, or that do a good job in the thriller genre?
No.
All right. No. So I used to read Clancy, Tom Clancy, when it was the 80s, I think.
Right.
And Clancy did a great job of research, and he knew the CIA, we believe he knew the CIA operations and the military operations and whatever his politics, his characters were into. But after I read a couple, I thought, there is absolutely no sex going on in these novels.
Right.
Nothing, not even close to it. And you right off the bat there, your team is a good-looking guy and a good-looking hot blonde from Kentucky. No, you put this couple together, and right away there, you might call it sexual tension, but right away for the reader, a little subtext there, you're wondering about these two as they go in and out of these dangerous situations. And I think it was one of your other books, I just opened up one of the first pages that I had not read, and it's the same thing. How important is that to crafting a great novel?
Oh, well, very intentional, very important. my earlier novels might not have been that way, but, I grew up, back to the Cold War, I grew up with Cold War novels, which has kind of informed some of my earlier novels. But a lot of these novels, especially the British novels, had very little sex, even sexual tension. Le Carré did a little bit of it, and it was kind of interesting. American novels are different, but there was a time when we all watched these buddy movies. There were usually two law enforcement types, they're both guys, and there's always something missing. And what was missing, obviously, is that the protagonist's partner should be female, and that changes the whole picture. But it's also contemporary without patronizing, women, when that's not what we're doing. CID, Army CID is full of female investigators, so we're not making it up. But we paired them together, and we made their personalities different. And it just adds another dimension to the book. But it also adds another way of looking at the world. Brody, my guy Brody, is very, very impetuous. He doesn't play by the rules. But Maggie Taylor plays by the rules. She's more intellectual than he is, and she's got instincts that he doesn't have. And like, it's kind of, you can do this with two guys, you can do it with two women, but it doesn't work as well. When it's male-female, the yin and the yang, that's also carrying the story. And even when there's not a lot happening in the story, and you're hearing these two talk to each other, that should be fascinating enough to bridge between the action scenes of how they approach the same problem. He's bound and intent on getting them both killed, according to her, and she's taking a little bit, you know, a little bit more rash, has a more rational viewpoint of how to do this. And I think, and it, I started doing this many books ago with my John Corey character, and it worked. So, still works, I think. How did you feel about that? You hadn't done that before.
No, but I knew we were doing it. So it, I was, and I thought, no, I thought it worked. It was fun. I mean, it was, you sit down to write a scene and you think, you know, what were you saying about, you know, if the author's having fun, the reader's having fun. If the author is bored, then the reader's going to be bored. Right. And it was fun. You have the two characters sitting down having breakfast and they're talking over what they're going to do that day. And it becomes kind of a pleasure to write because you know that you can have this fun interplay between the two of them. And they're both smart in different ways. They're both brave in different ways. They're both stupid in different ways. And it kind of hopefully gives you kind of more of a respect for each of them that they're able to work together and you find how they respect each other. I also like they're both, we didn't mention this, they're both combat veterans from different wars. He was Iraq and she was in Afghanistan. So that was that was interesting too when they were able to kind of tell the other one about their experience or times when they had a common experience or times when things were different between the two of them. So I think it worked.
So when you write, you have this little romantic side story here, perhaps at least the reader's wondering where that'll go, and you have a certain banter that develops between the two characters, yet they're in dangerous, harrowing situations. How do you, what's the thought process in writing dialogue to go with that so you don't minimize the danger they're in with the banter that they're sharing at that moment?
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, kind of like whistling through the graveyard. You know, they're in danger. We know the danger. If they keep commenting on it, they're going to seem wimpy. You know, they're going to, you know, and I guess, and maybe this is from my experience in Vietnam. We didn't talk about it. We were on patrol where anything could happen at any time. And yet it didn't stop the GI humor. Somebody had something funny to say about something every minute. I mean, dark humor, gallows humor, whatever you want to call it, whistling through the graveyard. You need to do this because you are in danger. It doesn't trivialize the danger. I think it actually highlights it, that you know why they're doing this, why they're having, why Scott Brody is making jokes. He's making jokes because obviously he's tense. You know, it worked in real life in Vietnam, and I think to some extent it works in the books.
I like the line when they get into the cab in Venezuela and they have a angry cab driver who hates Americans and he says, "Are you Americans?" And Brody and Taylor say, well, Brody says, "No, we're Canadians." And he says, "Yeah, those Americans, they stole our culture, they stole our money, they stole our oil, they want to steal our oil." And Brody says something like, "Yeah, they came and commandeered our Tim Hortons."
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, more of Ron Jolly's conversation with thriller writer Nelson DeMille and his son Alex.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Let's return to Ron Jolly talking with Nelson and Alex DeMille about their book, The Deserter.
So movies. One of the books, General's Daughter with John Travolta, Madeline Stowe, James Woods, big cast, came out late 90s, early 2000s?
Late 90s, yes.
Late 90s, based on your book. You have a background in film and screenwriting. Now you're together with a great action thriller here. Are there plans? Would this transfer to the film medium, Alex?
I've never written a novel before, therefore I've never adapted my own novel. It sounds really hard. I think I could do it. I think I would definitely need something between it. So we're working on a book right now, and the next kind of sequel to this book, maybe potentially after that. But I also think it's valuable to have another perspective, another writer, because it's not just about length. A script is only 90, 100 pages, and that we have this big book. It's also about...
Scripts, how many pages?
Well, let's say 90 to 120 pages, let's say. I mean, the general rule is a minute a page, even though that's not really true, but that's the expected. If a producer picks up a script and they never heard of you and your script is longer than 120 pages, they're going to be not take it that seriously, maybe, or unless it's really, really good. But so I think there's a way in which you have to kind of concentrate the story too and think, what is it about? You know, we have a lot of themes going on in this book. I personally didn't think about what they were before I started writing it. You know, we just kind of went, and I think it came naturally. You know, these recurring themes and ideas kind of came naturally, and when you saw them and they kind of popped up, you're like, oh, this is something to highlight, that's interesting. But with a screenplay, I found that you need to kind of have an idea up front about what is the one thing this story is about above all other things. There's this kind of hyper focus that makes it really difficult. So to find that in your own work, I think might be doubly difficult. I don't know, but I definitely think it could make a good movie.
Right. So I mentioned earlier tonight, I asked one writer, I said, you know, a lot of people will review your book and they'll talk about the themes that are running through the book and they'll dissect it. And I said, when you sit down to write a novel, do you say, what theme should I have here? And he says, no, I just write a book. And I suspect that that's the same. But what themes emerge then upon hindsight? Or what is the one thing you said that is this book is about?
I don't know the one thing. That's why I don't want to write the screenplay right now. I mean,
there were a couple of themes, and Alex touched on a few of them, and you know, suggested them to me. One is the kind of the endless wars that we're engaged in, that these characters could not have existed in the 1950s, but they can exist now because we've had Iraq, we've had Afghanistan for how many years now? 18 years or something like that. And somebody knows who's counting. But these people are veterans, and the people who populate the book, the Americans who are in Venezuela, the security, the intelligence people, and the embassy people have all been, they've gone through their tours. They've been Iraq, they've been Afghanistan. So it was like this endless war kind of thing. This is kind of what you see. Another theme was that, you know, we're producing a lot of combat veterans. And our bad guy, Captain Kyle Mercer, is also a combat veteran. Obviously, he was Delta Force. He's seen action. He's been shot at. So he has something in common with Maggie Taylor and with Scott Brody, the two people who are following him, which I thought was kind of interesting. It was when they finally do meet, what they have in common and what they respect in each other is the fact that, you know, we used to say in the Army, same mud, same blood. And we've been there. And these three have been there. Even though they're now on opposite sides, they can respect what each other has done. So that was another theme. And the theme, I think, of also, to some extent, American intervention. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. A lot of people think we should intervene now in Venezuela, but we're not doing it. But there's always that, you know, whenever you're writing a novel, like my last one, Cuban Affair, intervening in Cuban, you know, politics or Cuban society or trying to topple the government? So, you know, you write about the world you live in. It's the only world you can write about if you're writing a contemporary novel. And all these things are there. But they can't be there too much because people are going to say, I'm looking for the sex, you know, like get on with it. Or I'm looking for the violence. Nobody's bled yet and nobody's had sex yet. So, you know, you got to kind of mix it up. And if you do it right and you pace it right and you portion it out, it works. And I think this one works.
The novels that you both admired, though, were mostly Cold War novels set 50s, 60s, 70s, Russia, Moscow, et cetera. So this one is kind of Afghanistan, the Afghanistan endless war. But is there, is it difficult for a writer now if you don't have the Cold War to go to? Mm-hmm. So is it the Middle East? What's the go-to place? Or is there, what's the best place to set a thriller like this? Any kind of thriller?
Well, that's a good question. You know, I never did a lot of Cold War. I really loved Cold War thrillers growing up, and I really did grow up on them. And when I sat down to write one, which was the Charm School in 86, 87, and I went to Moscow and Leningrad, and I finished it, and I said to myself, this may be one of the best novels I've ever written. I think I've got a new career here. And then the Cold War ended. I knew at least one novelist who had a half a manuscript when the wall came down. But the reviewers were absolutely ecstatic about this novel. Some of the reviewers said, one of the best Cold War thrillers. So right away you think, well, you know, the Cold War, I mean, even though one of my characters in the book says communism doesn't have 10 years in it, you know, I said, even if that's true, I've got 10 years, I could write maybe 5 novels. And I was really excited about doing Cold War stuff because it was the battle of the history of the world, 2 superpowers, nuclear arm, what could be more exciting? And it was, you know, it was sex, it was violence, it was everything. And I'm surprised I hadn't done one earlier. But when I did that one, I said, this is how I'm going to move my career now. I am going to become the American Graham Greene, Le Carré, whatever. And then the wall came down. So what are you going to do, you know? But where do you set him now? Much more difficult because it's not, you don't have that. The Cold War is over. We have the war on terrorism. And everybody's given it a shot. And some more successful than others.
The Middle East, but it seems like there's so many changing sides right there. It's in motion. China could be a good place right for one of your novels. So there are 2 more coming out, by the way, same characters. Second one you're working on now. Mm-hmm. I asked Alex the other day, or I think I read, that you obviously read spy novels, but you read a lot of, or have been reading a lot of nonfiction.
Yes.
And now you're cast into this fiction writing role. Mm-hmm. And a thriller role, so there's got to be this page-turning mechanism here to make the reader just want to know what's going to happen next. Great storytelling. What did you learn in the process, if anything, with your dad? And Nelson, I'm going to ask you the same thing after this, but we'll ask Alex. What did you learn in this process about writing and about crafting a novel?
Everything. I came to it, with an idea of structure, with an idea of dialogue and how I enjoy writing dialogue. And also writing prose, which I hadn't done in a long time, but I missed and thought I was okay at. And so I was excited by that, the prospect of doing that. But I think there's certain things like brought from screenwriting, which ended up actually not being very helpful, that I think you helped me kind of break the habit of when writing a book, one of which would have been, there's this reflex to, you know, come into a scene as late as possible and leave it as quickly as possible. You know, do what it needs to do and then get out. And I did that a few times, and sometimes it worked for pacing, but it doesn't always work. And you have to really think that the pacing of a novel, I think, in some ways is more complex. So you were helping me kind of figure out, well, you actually need to, when these people walk into a room and see each other, that's part of the scene. You need to know what that moment is. And they're talking about this, but what about that? That would come up too. And you can bring the beginning and end of these interactions is really important. So you kind of showed me how the ways to kind of, the key scenes needed to be, you know, kind of milked in a way. And I think one of the other main things would have been when I was looking at this book from the outline perspective, which I didn't try not to do too often, but when you're in the middle of it, especially the middle of the book is, I think, the hardest thing, like a screenplay, and you're thinking about what's going to happen next. There's a few times where I ended up kind of overstuffing it because I was thinking just about plot. I wasn't thinking about the fact that we'd created these interesting characters and the reader's going to be interested and care about them because of who they are, and the story we've already formed is kind of an engine unto itself. You don't have to add even more complications. So I guess it's also the sense of focus and understanding how to focus the book, which I learned from him. And then also just the use of language. I mean, he's done this a lot, and he's obviously very good at it, and I had a lot to learn. And I think I did learn a lot, especially by having my own words edited. I mean, it was like the greatest writing class you can get.
Yeah. Great education.
Yeah.
Nelson, what would you say Alex brought to the project, and what did you get any new perspectives on storytelling or writing?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, novelists tend to ramble And, you know, when the middle always sags, they say. But, you know, there's something you can go back and sometimes edit. But with Alex, you know, he did know how to get into a scene. He knew how to get out of a scene. He knew where to make the chapter breaks. You know, he had a, what do they call it, the arc of the story. There was this, novelists do tend to go, we do a lot of, you know, peripheral stuff just to try to make the novel a little bit more atmospheric or whatever. But with Alex, you know, he did focus on the plot a lot because you have to do that in a screenplay. So I was aware of this. I was aware that he was, you know, going in one direction where I usually wander like that. So sometimes he pulled me back, you know, toward the plot. And also, you know, again, when should a scene end? When should it begin? Usually, you know, that you break them up with chapters. So I, just knowing I was working with a screenwriter, I think subconsciously, the cinematic, I was thinking, you know, act one, act two, act three, but scene one, act one, scene one, act one, scene two, et cetera. I started setting them in my mind, the scenes, and the book, I think, went a lot faster because of it.
The General's Daughter, I wanted to go back to that. That was your first experience, I take it, with having a book of yours, a story made into film. How did that process go? Any interesting stories out of that process? Did you meet Travolta and the cast?
Yeah, you know, I knew this. I knew the producer, Mace Neufeld. I didn't know him well, but he had done a lot of the Tom Clancy books. In fact, he's got the rights to the Tom Clancy character. But I met him somewhere along the line, and it was an interesting process. It was a process that, you know, if you asked 30 novelists to tell you the story of what happened to their book in Hollywood, you would get 30 of the same stories, not different stories. You get 30 of the same stories, and none of them are good. I had maybe a better experience. Sherry Lansing, who was head of Paramount at the time, who was studio making a movie, was also somebody I knew from New York from the old days before she went to Hollywood. So I had a little bit of a leg up. They invited me to the set. I didn't go for the couple of times, but then they said, you know, we're kind of wrapping the movie here. They were finishing it up in Burbank. I said, we'd really like to have you here for, you know, 5 days or four or three, or never, but no more than five. They don't want you around too long. And somebody told me, when the car picks you up at the airport, if it's a Cadillac or a Mercedes, they like you. But if it's a Rolls, they really like you. But it was a Mercedes. But it was okay. It wasn't the Rolls I expected. But it was okay. You know, I was on set. But prior to that, even though this was a studio-driven project, it looked like it was going to die because of one bad screenplay after the other after the other. And then they hired at the end William Goldman, who was a novelist who's written his own screenplays. William Goldman wrote Marathon Man, the book and the movie. And I said to myself, you know, because I have these prejudices about screenwriters maybe, I said, thank God they hired a novelist who knows how to write a screenplay. Alex is now a novelist who also knows how to write a screenplay. But then it wasn't that many around. It was Mario Puzo, it was Michael Crichton. But once William Goldman got into the project, he read the book, read the screenplay, and made all these changes and finally revived this project that was dying. And then when I got on the set, I sat with Travolta, and he had a copy of General's Daughter, and it was all marked. It was earmarked, and he had stickers in it, and he showed me lines that he underlined, and he made a lot of changes on the screenplay, too, but not, he made a lot of them, you know, that Goldman, I guess, agreed with, but it was just serendipitous that he's a very smart man, and Goldman is an incredible writer, and they got this thing, they got to the crux of it. So Alex says, you know, screenplays are 90 pages. It's a minute a page, that's the rule of thumb, maybe 120 is a two-hour movie. You got to take a book that takes 16 to 18 hours to read and get it down to 90 minutes. And that's a difficult thing to do. There's a lot of interpretation. A lot of stuff has to be cut. But they were happy with it. We had a good supporting cast. The movie made a lot of money for Paramount. John Travolta got $20 million to play the part. I say $20 million. I did not get $20 million for the rights to the movie rights. I got nowhere near that. As much money as the movie made is creative accounting. That, you know, I never saw another nickel, neither did anybody else. See, I don't know how it works in Hollywood, but somehow the producers get rich, the studios get rich. Nobody else, and usually the major actors make money. But it was very successful for you know, for Paramount financially, and critically it wasn't that bad. I mean, people took shots at it, but it was a good movie. And then when I wrote the sequel, which was Upcountry, with the Travolta character of Paul Brenner, who goes back to Vietnam, Travolta was supposed to play the part again, but this time Sherry Lansing had left the studio. And as soon as the personnel starts to change at the studio, all projects, you know, that were initiated by the last regime usually wind up being dumped. So that's kind of what happened, even though Travolta swore to me he wants to play this part again. He loved this part. But I think now, I think probably too old now anyway. But it was a good experience. I can't, you know, nothing, you know, I went there with the idea that I'm going to come back with a lot of these horror stories that other novels came back with. But I couldn't think of one except maybe sitting on the set and watching what was going to turn out to be maybe 1 or 2 minutes of screen time. It was a airport scene, if you remember it. The scene in the airplane hangar where they're putting the body on board. This is maybe 2 minutes of screen time. It took like 7 hours. But this time my eyes were rolling and I was saying, I can't watch this for another second. It goes on and on and on. They had a big budget. So they're going to burn up the budget. But I'm bored out of my gourd. And then they showed me the what do they call them, the night, the rushes?
The dailies.
And I watched it, and it was like over like 90 seconds. I said, that's what we did all day? Well, you know, it was interesting.
That reminded me of a quick anecdote. I was directing my short film. I was out in Easter Long Island, and you came to visit, and we were out. It was like a freezing cold autumn, and we were in the middle of this like field of dead grass, and it was something like a character was crawling through the grass or something. It took forever to set up. We had like a dolly and lights and reflective boards and everything, and you were watching, and then we did the shot. It was about maybe 5 second shot. We cut, and you said, "That's it."
Yeah. All right. Thank all of you for being here, and let's give it up for our special guests Nelson and Alex DeMille. Thanks for coming to Traverse City.
That was Nelson and Alex DeMille talking with Ron Jolly. Nelson and Alex wrote their latest book together, called The Deserter. Support for the National Writers Series is brought to you by the Wege Foundation, dedicated to developing leaders in economic ecology, health, education, and arts, and enhancing the lives of people in West Michigan and around the world. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org, and listen to past programs at interlochenpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerich.